It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
And now it's time for another extended edition of our Wisconsin News Roundup.
Governor Walker appointed a new state Supreme Court justice this morning. We'll look at how this will affect the court's opinions and the upcoming elections.
State lawmakers have unveiled proposals to reform the Government Accountability Board and restructure campaign finance laws.
And Governor Walker making headlines trying to work with lawmakers to find money for a number of delayed road construction projects.
Here to talk about those stories and more is Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. Robert, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
So Governor Scott Walker appointed Rebecca Bradley to the vacant seat in the Wisconsin State Supreme Court that just happened this morning. What do we know about Rebecca Bradley?
Rebecca Bradley was appointed to Circuit Court earlier by Governor Walker. She is a conservative justice and had support from the Club for Growth, from the Republican Party, and is seen as a quite conservative justice. So she had already announced her candidacy to run for the Supreme Court seat at the time when Justice Patrick Crooks died on September 21st at the Capitol. So that justice's death left a vacancy on the court, and today Governor Walker filled that vacancy. So she will run again in the spring for the April election, but she will now be doing it with the word justice in front of her name instead of judge.
Now, Justice Crooks was often considered a swing vote, so having Justice Bradley in his place, how is that going to affect the composition of the court?
Well, Justice Crooks did, in fact, vote. He did swing. He did vote sometimes with the conservative bloc and sometimes with the more liberals. Though it is probably worth saying that the conservatives have had really a majority on the court since Justice Lewis Butler lost re-election in 2008. So there were times when Crooks was probably one of the justices who could surprise you. He would swing. But it's not actually been and a trade of Justice Rebecca Bradley for Justice Patrick Crooks definitely makes the court more conservative, but it doesn't actually change the balance of power on the court.
Now, there had been some pressure early on from some of the other possible justices in the running for that seat that no one should take that appointment, or at least not just step in like that, because they would have a leg up in the election, which is coming up this April. So given that Justice Bradley now has this appointment, is this being seen as a leg up in that race coming up?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no doubt that incumbency is a leg up, right? I mentioned Justice Lewis Butler. He lost a re-election campaign in 2008, but since then, every time there's been a race, the incumbent justice has won. And I think that in general, incumbents have an advantage in these things. A Supreme Court election is weird, right? It happens in the spring. It's not a officially partisan election, though. Every time I've seen it, the partisan seem to line up and know sort of who they prefer. But it's not a high turnout election, and so it's the sort of thing that having the name justice in front of you or having the power of incumbency is seen as a major benefit. Now, it's not that long either. You know, it's not as if she'll have a long record of jurisprudence as a Supreme Court justice by next spring. So I think it's somewhat of an open question. But yeah, I mean, incumbency makes a difference.
Now, moving on to another story, state Republican lawmakers making news this week, and they unveiled plans to reform the state's Government Accountability Board, wanting to split it into an ethics board and an elections board, two aspects to that in their plan. What do they want to do, and what's driving that?
Sure. Well, this has been signaled for a while as a priority for among Republicans. And this week it was unveiled. So the Government Accountability Board was created in 2007 by combining an ethics board and an elections board into a single and more powerful entity. And that was at the time bipartisan creation and seen as a real step forward for good government. That is what now would be eliminated. So it would would go back to essentially what the state had before 2007. It would also be an explicitly political board, where right now the Government Accountability Board is made up of retired judges. Under this proposal, it would be split with there'd be Democratic nominee or appointees, Republican appointees, and then two appointees from the governor. So pretty much it seems to me like pretty much by design it would make it. It would ensure that the thing would be deadlocked around anything that was sort of charged or partisan in nature.
And what have Republicans said about why they want to make this happen?
So this is a direct response to the Government Accountability Board's role in the John Doe investigations. I think that is a clear relation. The GAB has an unlimited budget to pursue investigations of ethics issues, and the GAB had a role in investigations into coordination between Governor Scott Walker's campaign and conservative groups. Now, the Supreme Court recently ruled that actually that wasn't that they're allowed, and it's a new world out there, right? In the post Citizens United world, it's fine. So they quashed that investigation, but not before it caused a considerable amount of headaches and heartburns and cost the state a lot of money as well, investigating Governor Walker's campaign. So guess what? Conservatives don't like that. And I assume that if it were Democrats in power and the GAB were launching investigations into Democratic campaigns, they wouldn't like that either. So this is politics, right?
We're talking right now to Robert Menser, editor for Gannett Central Wisconsin Media, talking about the biggest news stories from around the state this week. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farach. We bring it back now to our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
Robert Menser is with us again. He's a storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. And Robert, another big story from this week centers around Wisconsin's transportation funding. This is an ongoing saga. Now Governor Walker is reportedly meeting with state lawmakers to try to find funding for a bunch of delayed projects. Where are we at with that situation?
So I love this story. This is like will never die. So the transportation budget was probably the most or one of the most contentious parts of the budget that passed this year, and here we are again. So due to a budget shortfall, the Department of Transportation has announced that it's going to delay a bunch of highway projects. There's a $482 million plan to expand Highway 10 in the Fox Valley. There's a huge $1.2 billion project to widen Interstate 39 south of Madison all the way to Illinois. And there's another one in Highway 23, Fond du Lac, and Sheboygan. There are others. But the point is they're putting off these projects by a couple years or more. And there's an argument that by delaying the projects, they're ultimately going to cost more. One estimate that I've seen is that it's going to end up costing the state $160 million more to delay. But how do you pay for these? So some people want them to go forward. So how do you pay for them? Governor Walker had originally proposed borrowing $1.3 billion in his first proposed budget to pay for all the road projects, but legislators didn't want to borrow that much. You will recall that Governor Walker was running for president back at that time, and so he said he would veto an increase in gas tax. He didn't want to see taxes raised. So there's kind of a stalemate, and now here we are. And so some of the same issues are back on the table. How much to borrow? How much to are there taxes to raise or fees that can be raised? Or do we need to do all these projects?
And so given all that extensive backstory, what's likely to happen?
Well, I mean, so what, the thing that I notice is that it seems to me that both Democrats and Republicans, both no one in the sort of in the Capitol is saying this delay is okay. We're okay with the delay. So it feels to me like the politicians here want these projects to move forward. So I think probably what ends up happening is some combination, right? A compromise where they're going to borrow a bunch of money and maybe they can hike some fees or something so that it's not all borrowing. But when I hear Democrats talking about it or see their releases on this, they're not saying, good, let's let these projects die. They're saying, let's find a way to pay for them.
our taxpayers in particular, you think, weighing in one way or the other on this?
Well, I mean, who likes a gas tax increase? That's not likely to be a politically popular policy. On the other hand, cars have become more fuel efficient, and the gas tax just isn't. It's been a long time since the gas tax covered the cost of transportation. There's an interesting thing that does exist in the grassroots among especially like environmental groups, which is really questioning the wisdom of some of these projects. So, you know, I drive Interstate 39 south of Madison. It doesn't seem that bad to me. I don't, you know what I mean? I wonder. And so there has been some environmentalist groups like the 1000 Friends of Wisconsin that have brought lawsuits against the State Department of Transportation about how they estimate traffic, you know, sort of project future traffic for these projects. And they've said, you know what, let these projects don't need to go forward.
We're talking with Robert Menser right now, editor for Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. We're getting our state roundup right now. And Robert, we're going to wrap up with a story out of the state legislature and a hearing this week on a bill that would allow college graduates to refinance their student loans. How would this work?
So this is a big Democratic priority. We heard they had introduced a similar plan last year, and they've introduced it again. There was a hearing. The idea is you can do it with your mortgage. If interest rates go down, you can refinance and try to get a better deal on the loans that you took out. It's actually unusual. It's actually odd that in a way that you can't with student loans. However, it's unprecedented for a state to pass a law that would allow this sort of refinancing. Wisconsin would be the first state in the union to allow it.
And as you said, this is a Democratic proposal in a Republican-controlled legislature. So given that, maybe prospects not so good. But are there any aspects of this that you think could end up working its way into some form of past legislation?
Oh, I mean, yeah, no, it's completely hopeless in the short term, right? There's no chance of that. But it is what Democrats are doing, and it's a legitimate thing to do is elevating this as an issue. And there are some elements within this proposal. There's one part that includes sort of increased financial counseling for students when they take out loans and for parents. And that's something that Republicans have said they can support, increasing the education on that. And what it really does is the discussion makes you think about the scale of the numbers. There are 815,000 Wisconsinites with student debt. The average debt for someone with a bachelor's degree is more than $28,000. And the total student debt for Wisconsin residents is $19 billion. So, of course, it has an economic effect. It definitely has an economic effect for people who are carrying around that kind of debt.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald, giving us our Wisconsin State News Roundup this week. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Now for a look at a Wisconsin legend, the life and work of the first American woman to die on a battlefield while working as a war correspondent. Her name was Dickie Chappelle, and she was from right here in Wisconsin.
Joining us now to talk about this fascinating woman is John Garofalo. He's a former entertainment industry executive and veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom. He's the author of Dickie Chappelle Under Fire, photographs by the first American female war correspondent killed in action. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Rob and Veronica. How are you both doing today?
Doing well, thank you. Well, Dickie Chappelle was born and raised in Wisconsin. Tell us about those early years in our state.
Well, Dickie was born in Milwaukee and grew up living in Shorewood. So she lived there until she was 16 full-time, and her parents lived in a fairly large house, and it was a good thing because she had an extended family that lived with her. She had her grandparents and aunts and uncles that were living there. So she really did have quite an interesting background with any number of parents, or I should say any number of relatives that were there that could, argue with one or the other about what she should be doing. And so I really get the sense that it was quite a chaotic household. But it really turned out very, very well for Dickie, because she certainly was a trailblazer during the course of her life, and it all started from her upbringing in Wisconsin.
Well, take us from that chaotic Wisconsin household to this decision to become a war correspondent, a war photographer.
Well, you know, actually, I have to say that that probably happened when she was still living in Wisconsin. And essentially, Dickie was a really smart kid, and I get the sense that she didn't really quite fit in with the other kids in school, but she did graduate at 16, so she finished high school in 3 years and was the valedictorian. But in her earlier years, she became enamored with Admiral Richard E. Byrd, who was a famed aviator and Antarctic explorer. And so I think that started the ball rolling for Dickie to really consider a non-traditional life and things that were filled with action and adventure and all that. And essentially, she wanted to be an aviator. And unfortunately, her parents were saying, there's just no way that our darling daughter is going to go into flying those dangerous airplanes. But her mother actually came up with the idea. It's like, I think that you're going to be a writer. And so Dickie had gone off to college, and she had gotten a scholarship to MIT when she was 16, which was very, very rare. I think she was only one of three women at MIT at that point. But she did take a journalism class there, but her intent was to study aeronautical engineering. Well, the aeronautical engineering thing really didn't work out so well, because she was much more interested in journalism, and she was even more interested in hanging out at the local Boston area Navy and Coast Guard bases and meeting with aviators there. And her first story that she had sold sort of as a professional was a story that featured the Coast Guard and essentially the way that they used certain kinds of telemetry for navigating their planes during search and rescue operations. And so from that moment on, she was kind of hooked with both still aviation and really decided that journalism was a productive way to go, particularly when she flunked out of MIT for not showing up to her class.
Well, she did end up studying photography in New York, and it sounds like her big break was when she got press credentials to cover World War II for National Geographic as a photojournalist, and she was in both Iwo Jima and Okinawa, two of the most gruesome engagements in the Pacific theater. What do we know about what that was like for her?
Well, the one thing I have to correct is one of the common misconceptions that she was in the Pacific on assignment for National Geographic, and actually her work with National Geographic didn't happen until the 50s.
Okay.
At that particular point, she did some work early on for Look magazine, and she was credentialed by a publication called Life Story to go out to cover the war in the Pacific. But when she was there, she went over to Iwo Jima on the USS Samaritan, which was a hospital ship. And so she was parked off of Iwo Jima for several days during the intense fighting that had been going on there. And she had seen the steady stream of casualties come in from Iwo Jima onto the hospital ship. So she had an opportunity to see, first and foremost, the terrible consequences of war, which can lead to some horrendous kinds of injuries, and she witnessed that firsthand for a while before she finally was able to get herself onto shore.
We're talking to John Garofalo. He's author of the book Dickie Chappelle Under Fire, photographs by the first American female war correspondent killed in action. Chappelle, originally from Wisconsin. John, let's talk about Dickie Chappelle as a photographer. Your book is mainly photographs, very amazing, striking images, tragic images often from World War II through Vietnam. What was she like as a photographer?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I had a chance to take a look at a large number of her photographs. Her archive, by the way, is over at the Wisconsin Historical Society over in Madison, and they house about 23,000 images of hers. And her photography actually came about as a consequence of her being married to a photographer. She really was planning on being a sort of a traditional print journalist, and her husband taught her photography, and so she really had some training from a fairly classic sense of photography as an art. Her husband, Tony Chappelle, was 20 years older than she was and had been a photographer for quite some time by the time that they were introduced and later married. And essentially, I think that he had that kind of influence to her as, you know, that era in which we're looking at classical black and white photography with, you know, very, very distinctive types of lighting and contrast and things. And some of her early photography definitely bore that out. But as time went on, and one of my favorite quotes that I had heard about her was from her stepson, Tony's son, Ron, who mentioned that that Dickie never met a light meter that she didn't like. And so she really kind of got caught up in the moment of, you know, really trying to catch these amazing moments. And I think that her photography really reflected that. And I've always said that when you take a look at Dickie Chappelle's work, what it really shows you is this authentic, I was there type of quality, because you couldn't get the images that she had gotten without being in some of these places that would allow that. And I think that's sort of extraordinary.
Could you describe one or two of her best-known photographs for us?
Sure. One of her best-known photographs came about from World War II, and it was a photo of a Marine who was laying on the deck of the USS Samaritan, clearly in distress. And he's got on his abdomen, you can see that there is a fairly large and growing blood stain. In fact, it wasn't a stain. You can see the blood pooled on the top of his his uniform. And again, you take a look at his face, and it's clearly distressed. And the photo title was called was released as The Dying Marine. And it turned out that was one of her most reproduced photos, and I would say probably up until the Vietnam War. But the photo showed this Marine in really this extreme situation. But what's always interesting to me is just a little detail that sort of pops up, because if you look at the picture carefully, here you have this wounded Marine who was just pulled off of combat on Iwo Jima, one of the bloodiest battles of the Pacific, and in his pocket you can see his toothbrush.
Hmm.
And so I always liked that little sense of normalcy that was juxtaposed with this horror of war that was very, very evident. Now, what was interesting about this particular photo is that the Marine didn't die. They actually were able to save him. And Dickie went to visit him almost a year later. He was still actually in a hospital recovering from his wounds, but he did survive and went on to live apparently a long, normal life.
This job as a photojournalist in war zones was dangerous. Ultimately, it took her life. What was her attitude? How did she talk about the risks she was taking?
Well, she certainly understood the risks of what she was doing. She had no false illusions about the fact that being a war correspondent was dangerous business. And even early on, she was well aware of the fact that in World War II, Ernie Pyle, who was the most famous war correspondent of World War II and his era, was killed by a sniper in the last days of the Okinawa campaign. So she knew what the risks were. And not only that, her husband Tony, when he was in Panama, he had enlisted or re-enlisted in the Navy and was a chief photographer's mate, teaching prospective sailors in the ways of aerial photography and things like that. And I want to say that there were three of the students in Panama and seven that were wounded. So she was well aware of the fact that it was a dangerous game. And she felt that it was important to do anyway.
This has been a story that has lived with you for a long time, and it's clear that you're passionate about it. What does she mean to you?
You know, it's really funny, because if you had asked me 24 years ago, when I found out about Dickie Chappelle the first time I'd ever just stumbled across her in passing, that 24 years later I'd still be working on the story, I'd say there's just no way that that's going to happen. But I really do feel that that she is a significant American that really deserves to be known by every man, woman, and child in the country. And I think that her contributions to journalism, and certainly the fact that she was a trailblazing woman, is something that was no doubt is noteworthy. And so I've really felt that it's important that somebody take that that charge and move forward with letting as many people know about Dickie as possible, because, you know, she was willing to go out and get herself killed to do what she did, and certainly I wouldn't advocate that as certainly a positive thing for everyone to sort of jump on the bandwagon. There's other ways to have a great, positive, productive life without getting yourself killed, but it still speaks to the fact that what she did was certainly noteworthy and I think worthy of the effort.
John, thank you so much for joining us and sharing her life story with us.
Well, Veronica, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
John Garofalo is a former entertainment industry executive and veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom. He's the author of Dickie Chappelle Under Fire, photographs by the first American female war correspondent killed in action.